Hello, everybody, and welcome to Going Shamanic. My name is Marielle Smith, and my medicine name is Running Bear Woman. I'm your guest host this evening for the show on children as natural-born shamans. This show is being pre-recorded, so we will not be taking any callers. As an introduction to the show, I'm going to read the foreword from the book Natural-Born Shamans, A Spiritual Toolkit for Life, that's written by Imelda Almquist. And the foreword is by international shamanic teacher, Sandra Ingerman. Giving birth to a child is such a precious gift, for life on this earth is precious. We have hopes and dreams for our children that they will blossom into individuals who will manifest a life that reflects their dreams and desires. We wish the best for our children and hope that they will contribute to the health of their communities and to the world. In shamanic cultures, when a child is born, they are recognized for the gifts and talents they came into the world with, and how they will contribute to the health of the community. Children are raised to embrace their true creative nature. They are taught that they are a part of nature and how to honor all of life on this earth. In community, everyone learns how they are part of a larger whole and how to support each child in encouraging strength in each other. The work of empowering children starts from when they are in utero and continues to when they are welcomed into the world and throughout their lives. In our modern day world, we have broken many of the laws of nature. And unfortunately, despite some of the gifts available to us that come from living in a modern world, we no longer support a healthy life for our children, teens, and young adults. Nor do we give them the tools needed to navigate through life, inspire them to be the most creative beings they can be, and teach them how to live in harmony with nature and with their own peer group. To reintroduce our children, teens, and young adults to how to live a healthy way of life on all levels is a desire for many parents and also our responsibility as a community. Many parents have lost their way, and due to the breakdown in behavioral issues of how children bond together, new tools are needed to heal the overwhelming issues that our children face today. We need to reintroduce children to spiritual principles that will help to empower them and lead them into living a fulfilled life that contributes to the whole. Imelda Almquist is so passionate about providing tools for parents and teachers who are seeking ways to heal many of the issues that our children face today. Imelda has courageously been willing to step out of the box and explore spiritual practices that can be bridged into helping children find a good roadmap in a world going through such challenging transitions on all levels. Natural Born Shamans, A Spiritual Toolkit for Life, covers all aspects of doing spiritual or shamanic work with children and young people. The book is written for anyone who has an interest in young people and providing them with a good spiritual foundation. Imelda covers group and individual work from in utero until age 18 plus. She describes the guiding principles behind shamanic parenting. Our guest today is Imelda Almquist, a Dutch shamanic practitioner, painter, and teacher based in London, England. She is currently raising three teenage sons with her Swedish husband. Natural Born Shamans is her first published book. Imelda, welcome to Going Shamanic.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you for being with us. So, how did shamanism find you? That's one of those great questions, right? How did we find our path? How did it find you?
Well, it certainly found me. There was one night when my three children were still very small, when my spirit allies came calling and said it was time to do shamanic training, and that they had been dropping hints and sending me clues, and that I was very slow to wake up to this fact. And then they used the word Google, because I said to them, but you know, like I'm in London, UK, I have three very young children. I mean, I can't go to the rainforest in Brazil to undertake shamanic training. It's not possible. And they said, no, you can even do shamanic training in the UK. They said, you have to go on your computer tomorrow morning and you have to Google and you'll find a teacher that you need to train with. But you need to do shamanic training. It's something you promised to do and agreed to do before you were born even, and it is time, but you seem to have forgotten that fact. So that's how a journey started, and I was very surprised that the spirit used the word Google, and this was quite a few years ago. So that's how it happened.
So quite naturally.
Quite naturally in one way. And in another way, it was a complete shock, because I was not planning to do more training. I was not planning to go back to school, as it were. Like, my waking mind was very busy with other projects and other concerns. So it was a huge wake-up call.
So when you did your searching on the internet, what attracted you to this spiritual practice?
Well, the spirits had told me it was shamanism I was to learn about. So I was following that. And then I also realized, once I started shamanic training and I started learning properly, I realized that there were many forms of shamanism I had been practicing all of my life. I just wouldn't have put the word shamanism to it. But I sort of realized that actually all of these slightly weird, unusual things I had been doing since I was a very young child actually had a name. It was called shamanism. It was called psychopomp work. And that was quite amazing to discover there was actually a name for what I was doing, and that it was possible to do further training in that and take that to a new level.
Oh, beautiful. So this book that you've written, what was your intent in writing this book?
Well, it really came out of, because I had three young children while training in shamanism, I soon discovered that I had the best teachers at home, actually. I'd come home from shamanic trainings. And then my own children would give me the masterclass. I would talk to them about what I had learned, and they would say, yeah, that is about right, but there is also this. And my own three children would like talk at a breakfast table about like where they lived before they were born and things like that, or where they go in their dreams at night and they go back to these places. So I quickly realized that I sort of had a master teachers under my own roof. And then I got this guidance from spirit. I mean, I started working with other people's children, doing healing sessions with them, and working with individual children who often had difficulties like being bullied in school for being different. And then the spirit said that, you know, to work with them individually, it's fine and it's important work, but you need to bring these children together. You need to form a group where they can share experiences and develop a spiritual toolkit, and also know that they're not alone. So that was the point where I started this group. My own children came up with the name The Time Travelers, and that's the name that the group still has today. And yeah, that's how it all happened, really. Realizing that young people do not only need to be given like permission and encouragement to arrive at their own set of spiritual beliefs in close partnership with spirit allies, rather than us like telling them what to believe and you know, what is what. Children can receive that directly from their own spirit allies. So my sort of discovery was that we need to give them that space. But as well as that spiritual space, they still need certain realities taken care of. They need a supportive group. They need boundaries around that, knowing that what they share is not going to go outside the group. You know, they need a physical space. They like gathering around a fire. So they still need someone holding the space for them. And that was the role I discovered. You know, I was to hold for them. But I really want to acknowledge that I have learned far more from this group of children than I could ever hope to teach them.
So you're talking about the time travelers that you speak about. You speak about a lot in the book as well. What kind of things do you do with them in your sessions together?
I try to always do what they need me to do. So I'm always asking them, like, what's going on in school or what's happening in your lives, or sometimes they get concerned about things that are happening in the world. So I have like a wheel of the year, and I sort of decide, you know, because I have to also like put it online to attract people. So I announce session plans, but if something happens, so there needs to be a change of plan, then what is important to the children or what is on their mind goes first. So really I try to work with whatever material is, you know, important to the children in that moment. And that's a very mixed bag of things. That can be a very different thing from the one week to the other week.
Are there some examples you can share with our listeners about what you've done with them?
Oh, I certainly can. It's almost like, where shall I start?
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I've introduced them to, you know, the main sort of principles in core shamanism, so they know all about like working with power animals and things like that, you know, working with the ancestors and going on journeys down your own family tree. We have done sessions on bullying, not me telling them what to do about bullying, but them receiving guidance from their own spirit allies, like what can you do? I mean, bullying occurs in all schools, even in family systems and social situations, and then receiving guidance from your own spirit allies. You know, we're not as powerless as we sometimes think, like what can we do? Arriving at a toolkit for that. So that's been a theme that comes back. So like from time to time, we return to that, work with that in a different way. We have worked around issues around self-esteem. We've done sessions even exploring what it might be like to be of the opposite sex. So where we've had, you know, boys dressing up as girls and exploring that, and girls sort of, you know, dressing as a boy and exploring that and running around. We've done weather shamanism. We've come to the Thames and worked with the great dragon spirit in the River Thames here in London. We've worked with the spirits of the land. You know, the group has been going for 4.5 years, so we've had the time to cover a lot of subjects.
So something that you mentioned a few times that's come up is the bullying and the challenges that kids have at school. Do you have some wisdom to offer maybe some of the parents or caregivers or teachers that are listening to help children in those situations? What could they call upon, or what could they do, obviously not having that group or training, but do you have some basics that they would be able to draw from?
I mean, we can talk about some basics, but also there is a filmmaker called Hannah Biedman who actually made a film about the time travelers, like working on the issue of bullying. So she made this whole film. So if people wanted to see that, you know, it's called The Time Travelers, and the film was made by Hannah Biedman. Then you actually see the children on camera and the children themselves like tell what they do and what effect that had in school. So I just want to give that a mention. That's probably the sort of, you know, the best way of hearing the children speak for themselves, and that is like out there, it's on Vimeo, so people can Google that. But then when it comes to bullying, there are many things from the field of shamanism you can use. Like if you want to not attract unpleasant attention to yourself, you could create yourself an invisibility cloak, for instance, or you could merge with spirit allies to become much taller and bigger than you are in your ordinary life. And you know, the person who's bullying you will not realize, oh, okay, you've just merged with a bear and I'm now face to face with this big, ferocious grizzly bear, for instance. But the person who's bullying you will quickly pick up that something has changed and it may not be such a good idea to bully you. So it's like little things you can do to make tweaks. Then there are things like Sandra Ingemann, who wrote that foreword you read out, she teaches about divinity and connecting with our divinity within ourselves, but always seeing the divinity in other people. So what the time travelers have found, that even when you're in a situation where someone is like treating you badly or bullying you, in that moment, you can still focus on their divinity, meaning the divine, the godly part of them. And the moment you are determined to see that and on the level of soul to connect with that, again, something will shift in the energy between you. You can also send energetic messages, you know, you can set boundaries. If you can walk into a situation where you think bullying is going to occur, you can do pre-harmonizing, meaning that before the event is there, you can start building the situation and sending energy and positive images there, so you make the situation easier for yourself. I mean, you can stand up for people who are being bullied. I mean, there's a vast, vast number of things you can actually do. So we're far less powerful than we think when bullying occurs, because we often go into a kind of victim mode where we get so panicked or we get so worried about the well-being of our child that we kind of like don't see for a moment. There are actually very sound spiritual techniques we can use in that moment.
Amazing. Now, you speak in the book about a life-threatening experience that your son Brendan had while while traveling to Sousse. Is it that right, Sousse? In which he calls on his shamanic tools to protect himself. I wonder if you could just share that story, because it's a really great example of how useful these tools are in everyday life.
Yeah, and that they really work and they can make the difference between almost life and death, or certainly between being seriously injured and getting off very lightly. So we were on a family holiday in Tunisia. This was about, I think, 3 years ago. And so we were exploring the city of Sousse, which is like a walled city. So we're just like walking around on a Sunday afternoon. And there were some young people, teenagers, on like, big mopeds or small motorbikes that they have over there. And one of them decided to make a game out of like running people down. I don't think that is fun.
Oh, no.
But so there was like a teenager, maybe a 14, 15 year old on like a motorbike like that. He had a younger child on the bike with him. And just for fun, he got it into his head that he would mow down a younger child. Mm. So, our son Brendan was something like 9 years old at that point. And he saw this motorbike coming towards him. And I was walking in front of him. I didn't even see it until after it had happened. Like, I stepped aside thinking this person was driving unsafely. I didn't even realize it was like a deliberate intention to hurt someone. Mm. So Brendan himself saw this like motorbike coming. And, then he also thought, I'll just step aside. But then the motorbike shifted course and still headed for him. So in that moment, he knew that he was going to be hit. And this, they were going to drive over him. He was going to be knocked to the ground. And because he's very shamanic, in that moment, he knew he had to call on his tiger powers, because tigers are his power animals, and he knows he has a whole team of them, and he talks to them every day, and he's very familiar with them. So in the moment, he knew he was going to be knocked over, and there was no escape from that. He merged, as we call it in shamanism. So meaning that we become one with, we say to these tiger powers, power animals, become one with me, fill me up with power, so I'm the most powerful I can be. So the motorbike hit him, he was knocked to the ground, so he fell backward, he banged his head on like the cobblestones, and this motorbike with two people on it went right across him, so across his torso across his face. So that's pretty bad. It could have been very, very serious. So at that moment, also there was like the gasp on the faces of people around us, like everyone was in shock. Mm. So I turned around and Brendan was just like, scrambling to a seated position. And then he told me what he had done. And he cut off, there was like a tire-shaped bruise on his chest. So you could see what had happened, but he didn't have concussion. He wasn't seriously hurt. He certainly had a big shock. But actually what he took away from it was like how powerful his power animals are. So he was like telling everyone that it was a really unpleasant experience. But he also said, I knew I had to call my tiger powers. And in the moment I did, it like made all of the difference. So what could have been a really serious accident actually for him became a confirmation of that. If we are in constant communication with our spirit allies and we call on them in these situations where we know we can't do it alone, they can save our lives. So he caught off with a shock and with a bruise on his chest, but he escaped, far worse injuries.
Wow. I'm just hearing you tell the story in your own words really brings to light the importance of having these tools in our daily life and being able to have call upon these allies. Thank you for sharing that. You make a distinction in your book also between a shaman and a shamanic practitioner. So your book is Natural Born Shamans. What is the distinction between a shaman and a shamanic practitioner? And why do you feel it's important to distinguish the two?
Well, this is a distinction that's commonly made in core shamanism, and it is because in indigenous tribal societies, the people who become shamans for their communities, they train for many years with elders and shamans, and they undergo many ordeals. Their training can last, you know, like up to like 9 years or something, and they experience hardships and tests and have to endure things on a level that, you know, we don't even know in Western culture, so to speak. So the reason that practitioners of core shamanism call themselves shamanic practitioners is out of respect for those people. So in reality, we end up doing a lot of the same things. Like we perform the same role in societies, like we perform the same tasks on behalf of the community. But it's an issue of respect, saying that we're not in an indigenous culture here. So out of respect for the immense journey these shamans make, we call ourselves shamanic practitioners instead. And then other people can call us a shaman. So you can say about someone else, you know, even if they're, a Western practitioner of shamanism. So others can call you a shaman, but it's a title that needs to be bestowed. It's like you wouldn't go around calling yourself a hero either. So it's a little bit like that. You know, others can sort of give you that privilege, but you don't take it for yourself.
Yeah, I've heard that quote before, that shamans don't actually call themselves shamans in any area of the world. They just are who they are. And it is the community that calls them, that gives them that title.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, shamanic parenting is also talked about in the book a lot. I'm very interested in that piece. Tell me a little bit about shamanic parenting and how we can live that more.
Sure. I think the biggest difference from like shamanic parenting and more like call it mainstream or regular parenting, I would say it's back to these spirit allies we just talked about, like Brendan's tiger powers, that when we do shamanic parenting, we acknowledge that there is a third party there, and also that, you know, it is our job to encourage and facilitate a really strong connection, you know, for the child to their own spirit allies. But also, and also children are natural born shamans. I mean, children are born with that connection. Really young children do all of this stuff naturally. That's why I call the book Natural Born Shamans. But often when the society's conditioning comes in and mainstream education, children start shutting down a bit and they start losing that. So in shamanic parenting, it's more a case of taking a step back and providing that space and encouragement for children to have the connection to their own spirit allies, but also then giving the child the space to really listen to what their own spirit guidance is, and then not stepping in the way with preconceived notions about decisions they should make or ways they should behave, but to really encourage them to live according to spirit guidance. And that is quite sort of different, because in mainstream parenting, the idea is that you are the parent and that they are the child. And because you're older and wiser, often you try to tell them what you think they should be doing. It's like a different approach, isn't it?
Very different. Very different. So I'm curious, in your time travelers group, are all of the parents interested or curious about shamanism, and do they practice it? Or do you have parents that are... I don't want to say not as open, but just not as open, I guess. And how does that work with children who are very interested in practicing shamanism and parents who are just bringing them there? Does that make sense? Like
yeah,
what is your
sure.
relationship and- like with them? Or do you help them find ways to connect to their children in that way?
Yes, well, in the early days of the time travelers, I actually invited the parents to be there as well. And then at some point, the children got older, and then it was better that the parents were not there so the kids could share things the parents shouldn't hear. But in the sort of first year or so, I allowed the parents to be there as well, so they could see exactly what had happened and that I hadn't pulled out a Ouija board or something like that. Yeah, but that fear is alive in our culture. And then I would encourage them to go home and continue practicing with the child. So the parents were, so to speak, learning a bit along with the children. You know, for as long as the children were so young where that was viable, but then at some point that was not viable. So I would say there is a range of parents. So it ranges from parents who are maybe not heavily into shamanism, but like if their child is interested or they've heard really good stories about the applications of the material. They're open-minded. So, you know, they drop the child and they collect the child, and they'll sometimes email me and say, oh, my child used something that you did with them in school and it worked really well. So you get some feedback. And then some of the parents of the time travelers, they are shamanic practitioners themselves. So they're really keen for their children to start as soon as possible. And also, you don't always necessarily want to be your own children's teacher, so to speak. Often it's better that they cover that kind of material with another person, right, another responsible adult. But I must also be honest and say that the most heartbreaking scenario, and it occurs, is where the children, young people themselves, are really, really keen. They want to make effort stories, they want to come and join the group, and then you talk to the parents. And often it's not even both parents, but, you know, you have a couple where maybe one parent says, yeah, I'm happy for the child to explore. And there is one parent who is more old-fashioned or conservative or fearful, and they'll say, absolutely not. And in that moment, as long as children are under age, you need consent from the parents. And I've explained that in my book as well. There is just no way you can do shamanism with a young person under age where the parent, one of the parents, doesn't give permission. So these have been some of the sort of most, you know, sad scenarios where I've sometimes been really upset seeing the enthusiasm of a child and like knowing that I just can't go in there. But also, you know, that is life. And on the level of soul, children choose their parents for a reason. So it's also surrendering to that larger process that they're, you know, they're the child of that parent because like lessons they've agreed to learn. And then I just have to stay out of that.
Right. Well, and I guess, too, we can hope that if children are natural born shamans, we were all children at one point. And perhaps as adults, we get reconnected to that that part of us when we do have children.
I think, you know, adults can do, but often, you know, if there is kind of 16 years of social conditioning on top, it can be quite a lengthy journey. I think it's possible for anyone who puts in the effort, and that I believe absolutely. And again, title of the book is Natural Born Shamans, because I truly believe we all have a natural born shaman within us, even those people who may not even be aware of that. You know, it's somewhere there within us. But as an adult, to start unpeeling all of these layers of conditioning, going back to that magical child at the heart of us, it can be a really long journey. And what I observe with the young people that I work with, if you know, you allow that to stay open and they do not shut down and they do not sort of disregard it, these people are incredibly, they're eloquent. They're resourceful, they're really well equipped. They handle challenges in school on a level where you say, whoa, you know, the spiritual maturity of that. And it just like seems a bit of a shame that not, you know, all young people could have access to that. But, you know, that's just my personal viewpoint.
Yeah. Well, and so speaking of that, there's something called shadow work that you talk about as well. And
yes,
with young people, and I've worked with it with adults and young people, but tell us a little bit more about why this is important to do with young people.
Well, shadow work is essentially all about owning the part of ourselves that we do not like, that our parents also didn't like. So from a very young age, we would have received messages about better not show that, not express that. And this is part of the human condition. You could not grow up even with the best parent without like ending up pushing certain parts of yourself, you know, away from view. And sometimes we even hide it from ourselves. We push it really far away. So we all have a part of ourselves that's like in the closet, so to speak. And then shadow work is all about bringing that which is like unconscious or unresolved or not liked back into consciousness. And by bringing it into the light and becoming aware of it, we actually find that it's a treasure trove. We find many, many, you know, wonderful things there. When we do shadow work, it's kind of challenging. It's not always very flattering. But when we do shadow work, we end up unleashing a lot of energy that we've ended up locking away from ourselves to fit in society and in our families. And, you know, with the Time Travelers Group, this is another theme that we return to, because shamanism teaches that we cannot teach spirituality or practice spirituality without looking at the shadow, the moment you're going to be working with light, the shadow is going to be very present as well. The moment you do a ceremony that generates a lot of light, the shadows will come calling. And also in our culture, you know, where we all have a shadow, if we do not become aware of that, then what happens is we end up projecting that onto other people. So the bits of ourselves that we do not like, we project onto others. So we get into these situations where we don't like this person or we talk down that person. And really what we do not realize is actually a part of ourselves we're projecting onto them. And if we could just own that and say, actually, what I don't like in this person, it's part of me as well. The moment we can own that and reclaim that, it frees up space between us and that person because they do not need to carry the shadow for us anymore. And this is not just something that happens on an individual level, it certainly does, but it also happens between groups of people. I mean, you see a lot of it in politics, you see it between nations. So I think the world is going through a paradigm shift at the moment. And I sometimes think if just like all human beings would actually do their shadow work, and if we as groups would do our shadow work in terms of other groups, other nations, maybe people of another race, you know, whatever it is we're projecting onto, that would take an enormous amount of tension that currently plays out on the world stage, you know, take that away. And we could all start, you know, seeing each other for the people we truly are. We could arrive at a whole new level of functioning. Again, it's an ideal, but I truly believe that.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree. Oh my goodness. That's a good one. It's something that my daughter talks about actually at school too, and how she,
really?
Yeah, she talks about how, why is it that we're fighting when we're all the same? And it's very interesting. And she talks about being triggered. Her and her friends have this word, right? Oh, I'm so triggered right now. And it is that shadow being triggered. So she and I are able to have that conversation. But so how do you start that conversation with the time travelers or with even with, do you talk about it with parents as well?
Yes, I do. Yeah. But also I think just, you know, also when you do stuff with kids, it needs to be playful. If you did it with grown-ups, it would maybe come out a little bit heavier. But with kids, you know, the thing is keep it playful, keep it fun. So with the time travelers, you know, you sit in circle. And then you just sort of say now, like, tell me about one quality you can't stand in other people. Or tell me about one person. If you go around the circle, tell me like one person you really can't stand, you know, for whatever reason. So the kids will sit there and they share, say, oh, you know, this selfish person, this arrogant, whatever, you know. And then all of these qualities are named. And then when the whole circle has shared, you say, you know, you explain the concept of shadow work in, you know, slightly simple terms. But I mean, they get it. Even very young children get it. And then you go around the circle again and you invite them to share like, OK, this, you know, person you so despise. Is there something in that that you can reclaim for yourselves? And the interesting thing with that is that teenagers find it harder to do that because they're more into like image and, you know, street cred and things like that.
Right.
So in the time travelers, it's been the sort of 7 and 8 year olds who just run with it. They just think it's another really fantastic game. Like, oh, yeah, one boy said, you know, I think he was 6 or 7 at the time when we did this. I'm like the master of darkness because all these horrible things I see in other people, they're all within me.
Wow.
And then you have the teenagers looking at him like, hang on, I'm not quite ready to go this far. But here you see the teenagers getting really uncomfortable. And here we have like a 7-year-old teaching, you know, older, like whatever, 13-year-olds, a really powerful lesson. And it's like, wow. And we ended up doing shadow work like one of the times, because it comes back to theme, but one of the times we did it happened to be the day after the school shooting at Sandy Hook.
Oh.
And it just like happened to me. I didn't know that that was going to happen. But, you know, on another level, these things were connected. So the children all arrived and they were very, very subdued. And like, why do people do that? Go into a school and shoot teachers and students and all of it and all of it. And our session was about, so we brought that in and then we did a lot of shadow work. And by the end of that session, or the title of the session was Meet the Monster. So by the end of that session, where a lot of it had been about Sandy Hook and exploring, you know, how that could happen and what had happened there, by the end of the session, I asked them, like, title of the session is Me the Monster. Who is the monster? And all the hands went up and they all said me. Mm. And no one said the monster is the guy who, you know, performed that school shooting. And I thought that was pretty awesome that they could arrive at that and that they could like own it. And, you know, obviously what that guy did was a, you know, a hideous thing. But still that the children could sort of, you know, own that and not wow. sort of call him the monster. In that moment, I really thought the kids had done extraordinary work.
Wow. That's amazing. Half the adults I know have a hard time looking at themselves and what's inside of them is also outside of them. Like, of it, course. That's amazing that the children are able to do that.
Yeah, so it's one of the session plans in the book, and really it doesn't take so much. Once you've got the basic concept, and also then, you know, you just need to make it more fun. After that session, like, you know, I put out a big bowl of sweets and chocolate, and I said, oh, you've all been very, very brave, and it's like a bitter pill to discover that all of this stuff is within us. Mm. But then, you know, all got to eat, like, sweets and chocolate to say, okay, let's sweeten this lesson a little, you have done well. So for kids, you just need to, you know, you need to make it fun, there needs to be a lot of laughter. But, you know, even very young children can work on an astounding spiritual level, you know, of like awareness and discovery.
Right. Now, speaking of that, it says that you also work in utero. How does that work? I'm going to kind of go down that path a little bit. You work yes. with children in utero.
Yes, I do. I just want to say that the way Sandra worded that is like, you know, because it's in a sentence that also has the word groups. I do not work with groups of babies in utero. I just want to say okay. that the ref, you know, it can sort of sound that way. But no, what she really meant was that I do individual work, sometimes only when I'm asked, because you always need to have permission for shamanic work. But I mean, there can be many applications of working with children in utero. I mean, I've had parents who've come to see me and they are pregnant. And they feel very strongly that they want the child to choose their own name and not just foist a name on that child. So you could do a journey. Or, you know, sometimes parents are very aware. They want to know who does the child want for godparents, what kind of naming ceremony do they want, what name do they want, and what is the spiritual meaning of that. And then what you do is you undertake a journey. So I have to, you know, I have the like mother in the room with me and I'll put my hand with permission, you know, on the bump. And then journey to the soul of that child and ask the child themselves to express those visions. And I think that's very, very beautiful, you know, that the unborn child gets to speak and voice wishes even before it arrives in the world, so that everything is prepared in a way that really welcomes that child. Mm. So, I mean, that's a very sort of benign application. But of course, you know, you can have situations where a person is pregnant and say that a scan has shown that there are like medical issues or there might be, a medical condition. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people have to make really difficult decisions. Are you going to terminate a pregnancy or not? Or are you equipped to bring a disabled child into the world? And then the thing is, and this also goes at the other end, say with people who are on a life support machines, it's not only for unborn children. The point I'm trying to make is that these shamanic techniques can be used even when the person is incapacitated on the everyday level. So, you know, they're not yet born, so they can't speak, or they are on life support in hospital, or they're severely disabled or whatever, where we cannot have a sort of, you know, direct dialogue. You can always undertake a soul-to-soul journey where you go and you make a journey to the soul of child. And it's best done by a third person, not by someone who's in the situation where there are emotions that are going to color it. So the work needs to be done by a person who's truly neutral. Mm-hmm. So you go, you undertake a journey to the soul of the baby or to the soul of the person who is near death in hospital. And then you ask for the wishes. For instance, with someone on life support, rather than the family having the responsibility of deciding are you going to switch off the life support or not, you can consult the soul of the person concerned. Mm. And, you know, to me, that's a much better way forward. Like, you know, for all parties concerned, same with an unborn baby. So journey to the soul of the unborn baby. And also when you do a lot of this work, you find that things are not always straightforward. There are no, there is no absolutely right or absolutely wrong way of doing things. Sometimes you do a journey and you're told by the soul of a child that, yes, you know, I'm here and there is this pregnancy, but I only want to taste life a little bit and then I will return. You know, it was never my intention to go full term. So I chose a pregnancy where there was going to be a termination. And then when you get guidance like that, it can be profoundly healing, because it takes that really severe judgment out of things, and it also takes away that responsibility to make life and death decisions about people who cannot speak for themselves. So again, it's a completely different way of handling these life and death issues or serious illness issues.
Oh, it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. So when you work with say children that are inside the mother, and you bring their name or you get messages from them, have you seen the results on the other side when they do come into the physical? And
yes, of course, because you know, then often, like when you do that work, like the parents will send you a picture, or you know, what might even happen is that all goes quiet for a few years. You know, you get the picture, oh, here's the baby now. And also, you know, London is a very multicultural place, so I work with people from all over the world, from you know, all sorts of different cultures. So sometimes, you know, I'll get the guidance and say, well, the name needs to be something like that, and then people will translate that in their own culture, saying, well, there is a goddess by this name, or the word for whatever snowy hawk in Finnish is this or that or whatever it is, and they'll arrive at a name that, you know, I could not arrive at, but that's absolutely right for that child. And then sometimes, like years later, out of the blue, you get an email or a message, a Facebook message, where someone says, you won't believe this, like the child has grown up a bit, of 4 and a half, now they can talk. And they come out with a story that completely confirms, you know, the journey that was done 5 years earlier. And, you know, it's just really, really beautiful that now there is a human being on earth, and it tells the parents a story. And then you realize it's the same voice, you know, when you did that journey 5 years ago and there was a pregnancy, this is the same soul speaking. This is the same person.
Oh, I love it. That's really cool.
It never fails to amaze me. It's always lovely.
Oh, and I think that's the magic to me about shamanism and practicing shamanism, are those magical moments, you know, a lot of time later that connects the past and the present. I love that. I love that.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, there are rites of passages for young people. We've obviously gotten away from it in our communities, in the society, and in living in, you know, big urban spaces. Why are these so important these days to have rites of passages for young people?
Well, as you say, we've lost it in our society, but all, you know, tribal societies did it, and many still do. And the thing is that I think the need for rites of passage is hardwired into young people, because it helps them close a chapter in their life and start a new chapter. So it's to do with these kinds of developmental windows that they move through. And if we do not offer our young people rites of passage, a few things could happen. It could be that young people start, because the need is there, it's wired into them, into their blueprint, is that people start initiating themselves. And, you know, just look at what young people in our societies are doing. You know, it is drugs, it is drinking, it is joyriding, it's going in for extremely heavy tattoos and piercings at a young age. And though there is nothing wrong with that, you've got to sort of ask yourselves, you know, what are these young people doing? What experiences are they creating for themselves? And are we on some level letting them down, that we are not hosting those same experiences, perhaps in a safer, supervised way, where they can work through these issues and move to the next stage in their development, you know, without doing it in a really unsafe way. You might also have young people who do not move through such, like, call them developmental windows. And then you get, like, people who do not fully grown up. And I think in our culture, just look at, like, you know, unavailable men, or, you know, mother's boys, or you have, like, women who are, like, well into their 30s, like, behaving like teenagers in the streets. There's nothing wrong with having a night out and having fun, but I'm just observing a larger phenomenon of young people. You know, the point of rites of passage in tribal communities is that, you know, they are put through a big challenge. An ordeal space is held by the elders of the community, often by the shamans as well. And then, you know, when you do it with teenagers, like, say, boys leave their mothers and they leave the village, they undergo initiations for a week. They return as young men. When they return as young men, they're ready to shoulder the responsibilities of young men. So they step up in their role in society. So you don't get these sort of, you know, the kind of eternal students we see in our society, where people are just not moving to the next level. And that's also about, you know, our responsibilities to our culture, and like, you know, we're all here on earth and we're all supposed to use our gifts for the larger good of society. We're not just only here for ourselves. So again, I feel we're really failing young people when we do not provide that, and we see the evidence of that all around us, I would say.
It sounds like, well, just you naming all of those pieces, the tattooing, the it sounds like they're, and even cutting, right? Like there's a sense,
oh, exactly,
of, a
yes,
sense of belonging,
yeah, yeah,
that they're looking
self-harm.
For
self-harm. Yeah, yeah.
And they feel like that is the challenging experience for them to step into their next stage of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it sounds like they're looking for it, and there just isn't a space provided, and that you're providing
no.
those spaces.
And then young people, I mean, you know, you know, I think you told me you have teenagers. Mm-hmm. I have three teenagers here in this house. And lovely and wise as teenagers are, they're also like life experiences they've not yet had. So when teenagers start sort of half, or not even half, almost unconsciously creating these sort of wild rides and experiences for themselves, it's just not going to be safe. Our society is not set up to hold it. Mm-hmm. And that's not what I want for my teenagers. And I'm sure it's not what any parent wants for their teenagers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. That sort of lights some things up for me about rites of passages. I wanted to move to the guests that you call on to work with your time travelers. You call upon elders, specialists, artists, initiators.
They're not all elders, I have to admit. Like, you know, quite a few of them are younger than I am. They're just like, in truth, they're like people that I know whose skills I admire, and, you know, more importantly, whose skills the children admire. And also, it's like just acknowledging that, you know, I am not an expert in everything. There are many, you know, areas, even within shamanism and spirituality, that I know very little about. So, and also, it's really nice for the children to have a fresh teacher, because they can get a bit bored with me after many sessions. So, you know, I bring in people like we have, you know, one colleague and friend of mine called Jill Hunter. She does animal healing work with them, which is an absolute favorite. The kids adore doing animal healing. I have another friend who does pyrography, like burning in wood, and creative writing with them. That people do drumming with them. I have a friend who's like a movie star and TV presenter who's told them a lot about, you know, presenting and standing up in front of your class and doing it like a professional TV presenter. And she's told us about the world of filmmaking and what goes on film sets and what we can learn from those kinds of scenarios. So, you know, like, I really am quite boring in comparison. It's really good to bring in these people who have amazing skills and experiences to share. And it's really fire the children up. They get very, very enthusiastic about things. So I'm lucky to have a team of guest teachers.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like too that it shares the collaboration and partnership that we can have as adults in being mentors or teachers together, instead of just being one person sharing everything about one thing.
Exactly. And also, like, not all of the people who come and share things with the time travelers have children of their own. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they also tell me that for them, it's a kind of, it's that experience of being of the young generation. And just like I say, they will say that the time travelers always like teach them more than they teach in return. So it really is a partnership. It's not teaching in the sense of, oh, yeah, I'll stand up here and tell you what to do. It's more a kind of like, you know, you enter into a group space, like a larger cauldron, where all of these amazing experiences can occur.
Well, go ahead.
No, but like, you know, like you just said, that's the great thing about it, that I just want to emphasize that it's two-way traffic, that like they learn as much from the experience and from the kids as they teach the kids.
Yeah. I love that part of doing group work. Is it seems like any time that I want to put something on, I feel like it's better done in partnership or with somebody else. I just love the synergy and the energy that happens when there's more than one person being a part of it or doing the teachings. I just think it's like the village. It's like the village raising the child instead of just one person.
Well, exactly. And in a very, you know, small way, I'm just trying to like make my way back to that, like, mm-hmm. you know, just offer young people that experience again, because you mentioned the word mentors earlier. And I think that's such an important word. But people often think that, oh, your material is not relevant for me because I don't have children. Well, actually, there's so many young people out there, you know, you could be, if you wanted to, a mentor for. And sometimes having a mentor who is not a parent makes that person a lot more fun and interesting, because they're not in that parenting zone the whole time. So often from the young person's point of view, these people are way more interesting. So if we could just rediscover that and also sort of see, as tribal people say, that, you know, all the children in our society are the children of all of us. They represent the future of all of us. When we are going to be really old, they're going to be the doctors and nurses and teachers, politicians. They're going to be running society. So even the concept we have in our culture that we have these nuclear families and that the children only belong to the parents and, well, maybe the grandparents and aunties and uncles, but, you know, that kind of like nuclear thing, it just doesn't work very well. If we can open that up and bring in mentor and like have larger networks, it's better for young people and it's better for everyone.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, children are very creative. You have some amazing shamanic artwork online. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what shamanic painting is and maybe how you've used this in your groups with the time travelers or for yourself.
Well, the time travelers like doing art. Actually, on Monday next week, they're going to be rune magicians. We're going to be carving a set of runes. So that's the next art activity that's on the program for them. Yeah. And yes, you know, I was a painter long before I became a shamanic teacher. And I would say that when you do anything creative, could be painting, could be writing, could be making music, again, it's all about that connection to the spirit world. So for me, when I make paintings, and I call that making sacred art, I teach courses in that. For me, it's about, you know, connecting to another world and making paintings that reflect that other world and reflect, for instance, those power animals that Brendan talked about, the tiger powers. It's about making art that is uplifting and that opens portals on other worlds. So it, you know, invites people to sort of have an experience of that themselves, connect to spirit allies, you know, connect to divine guidance, and, you know, be in that connection with other worlds. Personally, that's the kind of art that I enjoy making. It's certainly not in what most modern art is. So, but that's just like where I, you know, where I enjoy working.
Do you do journeys before you do your shamanic artwork?
People always ask that. The answer is no. It's the act of painting that is the journey. And that's the delicious thing about painting or writing. It's like you do a shamanic journey because essentially you're in that hotline with spirit allies and powers larger than yourselves. But, you know, painting is something you can do it for a whole day, like it's like a journey that lasts 8 hours. Like, imagine how delicious is that. You stand by your easel and you're in that zone for 8 hours straight. So I mean, it can be, it's more the other way around. You know, I'll do a journey and something comes up where I think, oh hey, that would make a fabulous painting. But I would say that for me, the really big discoveries and much of what I have learned about shamanism is actually through the art of painting, of writing. Because the moment you do it, again, you're working in partnership with these, you know, other world forces. And that's where immense learning and true creativity occurs. It's that marriage between the worlds. And the moment I let go of this ego idea that it's like all mine or it comes for me personally, if I can let go of those kinds of like egoic concepts, the moment I can just acknowledge, no, it comes from other worlds and I'm in service to life, I'm in service to that process, then, you know, this vast array of possibilities opens up. And also, you know, you never get artist or writer's block that way. When you work that way, you know, creative blocks don't exist.
I love it. I love the word delicious that you used to describe
doing. Oh, that's a friend and colleague of mine who uses that a lot. His name is Alec Davis. And I've sort of copied him a little bit because, you know, I just love the way when he does that. And sometimes it's the only word you can use. So got inspired by a colleague there.
That's great. Well, we're coming sort of to the close. I want to just read an amazing quote from your book and then ask a question at the end. So
Okay.
the quote from your book, what options are there out there for young people? Can we respect them enough to give them the space to express their innate soul connection to the divine in whatever form that takes for them? Shamanism is not for everyone. I am well aware of that, and I will never try to convert anyone. There is no one true faith. However, to stay sane and healthy on a level of soul, we all need a spiritual orientation and cosmology in the sense of our own understanding of the cosmos or universe. So, why do you think, in your experience, is it so important for young people to find their own spiritual pathway?
Because I find that when people lead a life where there is not a strong connection to spirit, or like many modern people today think you can lead a life without a spiritual dimension, and those lives are not satisfactory on the level of soul. And sometimes people can go for half a lifetime, but then they hit middle age and they fall ill, or deaths occur around them, or and they suddenly realize I'm not equipped to deal with this. So, with young people, then it's not, as I say, about it's not about me telling them what to do. Like with all my students, adults as well as children, I always say, go with what your spirit allies say. Do not go by what I say. But to me, giving children a spiritual belief system, or ideally helping them to receive that themselves, is like you build them a ship for the sea of life. So you give them like a spirit canoe so they can stay afloat. If then over time they realize that whatever you gave them, it's not right or not enough, and they want something different, that's fine. They can go and build themselves another spirit ship, maybe a bigger one or a more fancy one. But like if you do not build them some kind of ship, how are they going to cope on the great ocean that is life, where they're going to be tossed around and there are going to be big waves and there are going to be tempests and storms? So if you do not equip them for that, then in what position do we put them when the hard things in life happen, the difficult situations?
Wow. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. So, Imelda, how would you like to close? What would you like to tell our listeners about your wisdom about working with children and shamanism in the modern world? What would you like to end with?
I think maybe to say that as parents, we tend to speak a lot because we want to get a message across to children and young people. And I have found that the true riches, lie in being a very good listener. I think it's more about really, really listening to them and not always being in a rush or taking them to the next activity or telling them to wash the dishes or whatever, but really sitting down with children and young people and opening that like a sacred space where there is no judgment, so they feel safe enough to share what's really going on. I think if you can do that with your own children or with other people's children or with children you teach, then you keep that line of communication open. And I sometimes think that is the most precious thing of all. You may not like everything you're going to be taught. Some of it may frighten you or may sound very, very alien because you're from a different generation. Things weren't like that in your days. But I would sort of say that that's almost the most important thing of all, to do more listening than talking.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time today, Imelda.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, it's amazing. Thank you for your contribution to children's spiritual development. It is an honor to speak with you today and really for writing this amazing, important book that I highly recommend everybody read. To find out more about Imelda Almquist and her work, you can visit her on the web at shaman-healer-painter.co.uk. That's the right
Yes,
website. Excellent.
that is the right website. Or if you just
Excellent.
type in my name, some websites will come up as well.
It'll pop up. And I invite everyone to check out the book. You can get it on Kindle. You can order it online. It's a beautiful book. It's so honest. it's just got such honesty to it, and it's a great read. Thank you, everybody. I send much aloha to all of our listeners. And thank you to Jen and Gracio Snowhawk for inviting me to be the guest host today. Bye for now.